The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It is truly an honor for us at the Free Library to have such an icon of children's literature here with us today. Chris Van Allsburg is the author and illustrator of the acclaimed picture book Jumanji and The Polar Express, both of which were adapted into successful major motion pictures. He's the winner of two Caldecott Medals, the National Book Award, and the Regina Medal for Lifetime Achievement in Children's Literature. His new book tells the story of Annie Edson Taylor, a retired charm school teacher who endeavors to be the first person to go over Niagara Falls in a wooden barrel. What an adventure. I can't wait to hear more about it, so please join me in welcoming Chris Van Allsburg, everybody.
So I have some images here on my PowerPoint that actually are images from other books. And what I like to do, because I often speak to children, is to answer with a couple of examples. The most often asked question that I get in my mail from kids, any ideas what that might be? The number one question that authors get in the mail, now maybe not all authors, but me anyway, what do you think? Okay, there it is. Where do you get your ideas? Now, I'm not going to go through all of them. I mean, sometimes when I have a lot of time with my audience, I can actually tell them where each idea came from. This one happened to actually be autobiographical because it happened, so all I had to do was remember it. But I will get to one which I think... Okay, there goes years of work. Well, here's one, and this is a simple one. I'm sure that you're all familiar with the alphabet books that you bought for your kids, and you children in the audience have seen a lot of alphabet books, and how many times have you seen A is for apple, B is for banana, C is for kumquat? Does kumquat begin with a C or a K? All right, I did not have that alphabet book. But anyway, it occurred to me, and this is where inspiration comes from, it occurred to me that that's boring, to learn the alphabet by learning the names of things that sit on your kitchen table. So I thought it would be great to have an alphabet book where things happen to the letters. So it's about verbs, really, and in this case, each letter got... an action imposed on it, and that verb begins with that letter. So here is the Z getting zapped, and the D getting drowned, exactly. Now people say, well, how do you draw things like that? Well, some things you can make up, but some things you have to be able to look at when you draw. So I actually built a little stage. I got a curtain. I went out and got a fishbowl. I cut the letter D out of wood, painted it white. And then the last thing I had to do was go to the pet store and get a little fish. I asked if I could rent it, because I didn't really want to become a fish owner, and they wouldn't let me rent the fish. But I drew fast and had to feed him a couple times. And then they actually let me return the fish, because so fish is glorified now. All right, now this is an easier one to explain in terms of where ideas come from. And the point that I try to make when I talk about this particular book is that ideas come from very ordinary experiences. I think a lot of people believe that for artists, ideas are the result of painstaking hours of isolation in a room while they stare out the window, they rack their brain, they've got a piece of paper out in front of them, empty for days and days. This idea came to me one morning when I woke up and I went down to prepare my breakfast in the kitchen, and I saw two ants on my countertop. And that's not such a big deal. You've all seen ants on your counter, yes? Sure. So I saw these two ants crawling across the countertop, and I thought, where did they come from? I assume they came from my backyard. And while I was thinking about that, pouring my Cheerios, I said to myself, that's an amazing adventure for an ant. That's an incredible trip, because they had to walk out of my backyard. They had to find the edge of my house. They had to crawl up the side of my house, which for you and I, well, we were just standing there. We look at it. But for the ant, it's Mount Everest. So this is the ants walking through my back lawn. So the idea here was just simply telling a story from a different point of view. What's the world like when an ant has to do something like this, sneak into a human kitchen? Of course, I don't have other images, but bad things happen to these ants because as the human being, myself, prepares breakfast, he is unaware that the ants are there, and many very bad things happen to the ants. A story about the future? Yes. this is a story about a dentist who's not very kind to his dog, and the story is actually about getting even, which was actually inspired by, I was in Paris, and I saw a man in a very nice blue suit mistreating his tiny white dog. And so, once again, not something that was a result of you know, sitting in a room, you know, biting on pencils and pulling my hair out. I just saw this picture of a man dragging his dog along, and I thought, there's a story there. And in this case, the story ends up, the man that you see there is a dentist who's not a very kind dentist, and he's given figs which make his dreams come true, and he doesn't take it seriously, and he eats a fig. And the next morning he wakes up and he sees, in fact, that his dreams do come true, which in this case involves the Eiffel Tower slumping over. All right, now this is an easy one to explain, and I think in some ways the most amusing. My daughter, when she was about 6 or 7, she had coloring books like many kids that age have. And I went into her room one day, and she had on the floor a Walt Disney coloring book for Peter Pan Walt Disney coloring book. And the image that was open on the page was Princess Tiger Lily, who was in a pool of water, and she was drowning, and she was calling out to Peter to come save her. And so in the image you see in the foreground, Princess Tiger Lily with an expression like this on her face. And off in the distance you can see Peter flying toward her. Now my daughter had taken that picture of Princess Tiger Lily, and she'd taken yellow and green and purple crayons and done this to the princess. And when I looked at it, it seemed to me that the princess was doing this because of what my daughter had done to her with the crayons. So I thought, well, there's an idea for a story. What if there was a world where the characters in the coloring book didn't know they were the characters in the coloring book? This was their world, and the world was perfect. It was pristine. There was no color in it. There was nothing but nice, simple black lines. And so what happens in this story is that this simple western town, one day a coach pulls into town. It's covered with this hideous material that no one's ever seen before. And they are simply the crayon marks, because up to this point, the coloring book was on a shelf in a bookstore. And it was purchased and given to a young boy. And now the young boy is working on coloring his book. And it's a great shock to the the inhabitants of River Bend, and they have to deal with all sorts of terrible things, because what happens, the coach comes into town, is covered with this red goop. The sheriff, who is the hero of the story, rides out, and he finds the coach driver on the side of the road, and the coach driver can't account what happened to him. He saw a blinding light, and suddenly, the next thing he knew, he was he was blue and green and red. And this is a story whose inspiration was occasionally inspiration for stories. That is, it was a sequel to a book I wrote some years earlier. It was called Jumanji, and it was about a jungle adventure game that came out of a game board. and it became a film. The studio was very excited about a sequel, and they came up with some very, very lame ideas about how to do that, which would include, among the lamest, I would say, that the President of the United States, on a tour to while he's traveling in Europe, comes to, finds a little antique shop, and he discovers the Jumanji game board, and he gives it to his children. So all chaos breaks out in the White House. And I told the studio that I couldn't think of a stupider idea. And so the producers that I was talking with, I said, is there anything that could derail this? Because they were very serious about making it. And I saw it as a potentially humiliating thing for me. They said the only thing that will dislodge this idea, that will derail it, is if you have a better idea. And I said, well, I think there is a better idea. So the idea that came to me was that you didn't have to just play the jungle game again. You could actually have that game board, the Jumanji game board, have another board inside, and you could play another game. And in this case, instead of bringing jungle animals into the house went away, and it went into outer space. But it did produce the same sort of visual kind of pictures that were the inspiration for me when I was doing Jumanji, and that is this idea of cognitive dissonance, things that don't belong together. Now, there's nothing odd, I suppose, about a picture of outer space and nothing so strange about an open front door, but when you put them next to each other, you've got some other kind of drawing. This is a story, it conforms to a classic folklore story model, which is that there's a powerful character who has sort of the strength and size advantage over a smaller character who's much more clever. So this is a story about a brother who spends the whole day, not the whole day, but he spends the first half of his day tormenting his little sister, but she in turn torments him, but he doesn't even know it because she's the wily one. So this is my new book, and it's called Queen of the Falls, and it's a departure for me from all the other things I've done, because everything up to this point has been a fantasy. The only thing that I really had to sort of honor were my own ideas, my own fantasies, my own imagination. This is different. This is actually an event that happened, though it's so crazy, you could accuse the author of having made it up. When I was around 21, 22 years old, I read an article in a magazine called The Daredevils of Niagara Falls, and I read this article and many amazing things in it, but the most amazing thing in it, this would have been in the early 70s, was that the first person to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel was a woman. So that I thought was pretty remarkable, and then I learned she was a 62-year-old woman and that she was a retired charm school teacher. And now in 1960, or when this happened, 1901, the age of 62 was a little bit more like 72. I mean, that was an older person at the turn of the century. But finally, the thing that amazed me the most was that I got to be the age of 22 and I'd never heard of this. I mean, it seemed to me at some point my fourth grade teacher, my fifth grade teacher should have told me about this. This was, I'm not going to compare it to Lindbergh crossing the Atlantic, but still this was a remarkable achievement and undertaken by such an unlikely character that I thought, well, this is an important part of Americana, because America is built out of nutty people like this. And that's maybe not fair. She wasn't nutty. She had this idea, and she believed it would work. So I actually start out the story as her barrel is going over the falls, and I knew the first image that I wanted to present was an image that established for kids the size of Niagara. It's as tall as a 17-story building. And people who've not been to Niagara, it's difficult for them to appreciate just what a massive, mind-blowing thing it is to stand close to Niagara Falls, because it's just, as I describe here, imagine being as small as a flea standing on a sidewalk next to an open fire hydrant, and that's what it's like standing next to Niagara Falls. It's just, you try to approach it, you know, kind of blasé. I've heard about this. Yeah, it's a big deal. I've seen pictures. What are we going to do afterwards when we can go to lunch? But when you see this thing, it really takes your breath away. So I was trying to create a picture that sort of established that. And then the story goes on to describe the group of people who are gathered around the base of the falls to watch what at this point in the story we think is simply a barrel. And the question is posed, well, why did all these people come to watch this barrel just go over the falls and be crushed to little pieces? And the reason, of course, is because they knew it was not empty. So at this point, the story jumps back a few months in time and about 300 miles west to Bay City, Michigan, and we're introduced to Annie Edson Taylor, who's a 62-year-old charm school teacher who teaches young children how to waltz, how to use the correct fork at dinners they'll probably never be served, and how it's better to use a hanky than the back of your hand sometimes. And so she had a pretty good-sized student body when she started out, but as Midwesterners overcame their inferiority complex relative to the sophisticates of the East Coast, her class shrank, and she was left with a final student here who's not sure he wants to go on the dance floor with her. And that was the end of her livelihood. She had no way to make money, and she was puzzled about what to do next. And this is probably the most mysterious and puzzling part of her sort of story. She could have become a domestic. She could have cleaned houses. She could have worked in shops. She could have become a seamstress. But none of these things satisfied her. They all seemed too humdrum. She was 62. Didn't know what to do, but she thought that there was something that she might be able to think up that would be so spectacular that if she could accomplish that spectacular thing, then having achieved it, she could go out onto a lecture circuit, just like I'm here now lecturing you, but she would be there with a great big barrel, and she would be talking about this extraordinary thing that happened, and people would pay money, and she could go from city to city in early 20th century America, and she would be set for life. She wouldn't have to worry that her charm school no longer operated, and there was no safety net back then. There was no Social Security. Being unemployed at 62 meant either depending on your children or living in the poorhouse, which was really an unhappy place. So anyway, this is the mystery. This is the mystery moment, and she was not able really to account for how she got from point A, what am I going to do next, to point B, go over Niagara Falls in a barrel. But this is the set of illustrations that I came up with to try to describe her moment of insight. And she was reading a newspaper, the Bay City Bugle, and it was describing the very large crowds that were in Niagara that year because there was an exposition in Buffalo. So the crowds were especially big in Niagara. She'd been to Niagara when she was a child and remembered what a, you know, awesome thing it was. And so it's just one of those miracles of how, you know, neurons connect. And so the picture on the right shows her moment of epiphany, that her future lied in climbing into a barrel and going over Niagara Falls. So sometimes crazy ideas like that only last a night. You wake up in the morning and you say to yourself, what was I thinking? Annie woke up the next morning and got out a bunch of paper and started drawing the barrel that she knew had to be made for her. Now, the barrel could not be too big. Now, why can't the barrel be too big? Any ideas? Yeah, I'm sure some of you may have done this. You have to design little containers so you can drop an egg from a certain height and not have it break. She had to have a barrel that was small enough so that she wasn't going to bounce around inside it and break every bone in her body. But she also knew that if it was too small, it would not have enough air for her inside because this barrel was watertight and it was airtight. So she had to have enough air in there so that when she was set free upriver above the falls, that she would be able to have enough air to get to the lip of the falls, go down, and maybe be trapped for a little bit at the bottom of the falls and be able to breathe and until her rescuers came and pulled her out of the barrel. She was actually more worried about suffocating than being broken to bits. So she drew this design up, and she went to the barrel maker who was used to making barrels for pickles and beer, and he'd never seen a barrel design like this, and he said, what's it for? And Annie, confident in her design and in her idea, she said, well, I'm going over the Niagara Falls in it. And so he threw her out of the shop because he thought she was crazy. And he said, you know, if you want to commit suicide, you'll have to do it on your own. I'm not helping. But she went back. She went back 2-3 times, finally persuaded this barrel maker that it was possible. And she built this very strong barrel that was just right size for her. And I have drawn an illustration here on the right that describes the insight Annie had, that you can make something very, very strong, but if you put something fragile inside it and you can drop it from a height, when you look at it, the container is fine, but when you open up the container, it's bad news. So there's a broken egg inside. So the next thing Annie knew she needed to have was somebody to help her publicize this. If she went over Niagara Falls, she didn't want to do it on Sunday morning when nobody was there. So she got this carnival barker named Frank Russell. She hired him, and when he met her, he said, "Aren't you a little old for this?" You know, he was worried that she probably wouldn't survive. In fact, he was certain she wouldn't. And at that point, Annie said, "Well, in spite of the fact she was 62, she says, "I'm 42," because she understood that the public would be more interested in a young daredevil than an old one. So he didn't believe she was 42, and he didn't think anybody else would either. But if he thought if she could by some miracle climb out of this barrel, that there definitely was money to be made. So Frank Russell went on to Niagara Falls. He got all the newspapers excited about this woman who was going to come and do this. He described her as a 42-year-old adventuress. Not true. And that she spent a lot of her spare time swimming frigid lakes and climbing mountains. And so the reporters were very excited to see a particular kind of person climb off the train. And they saw this woman who, as it says in the text here, a woman who appeared to have spent considerably more time baking pies than climbing mountains. And they thought it was all a hoax. But when they talked to Annie, when she was interviewed, very sincere, had absolute conviction that she was going to be able to accomplish this. And so they thought, well, maybe as ridiculous as it seems, this woman will get into this barrel and you know, days from now, we will either watch someone die or we'll observe a miracle that she climbs out of the barrel. So they put the barrel on display in a big hotel in Niagara. And, you know, Frank Russell thought, well, let's let 10 days pass and really build up the excitement. And it did. I mean, you know, people were just eager as could be to see this thing happen. And, you know, probably not a particularly admirable part of human nature, but there probably a large percentage of them thought that she was not going to make it, and they wanted to there just to see the tragedy. But she set off from the river above the falls with two trusty rivermen who were going to row her barrel into the middle of the river. There was a little island upstream from the falls. They took the barrel off, and Annie, you know, it's funny when you think about this, you think about the clothes Evel Knievel wore when he did his daredevil thing. She wore the clothes she always wore. She just took her hat off, and she took her coat off, and she backed into the barrel. And one of my favorite pictures in the book is just her saying, "So long, boys," and as they hammer the lid closed. And they row her out into the river. They get her to the point of no return where the current's moving so rapidly that they have to cut the rope if they want to save themselves. And they row back as quickly as they can to shore, and off the barrel goes. And as it goes down the river, there's people not only at the base of the falls but also along the rapids. And they can see this barrel coming, and the word goes out as she goes through the rapids that are above the falls, which in Annie's description, and she anticipated, would in some ways be the worst part of her trip, because the barrel gets flipped around, goes underwater, gets tossed up, flies around. So here we can see Annie inside the barrel suffering the violent trip that she was taking down the rapids, and bang, 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 yet Annie knew the worst was still to come. Fred Truesdale, who was one of the boatmen, had told her that the water at the very edge of the falls would be still for a moment. When she felt that, he warned, she must hold on for dear life and pray. Which was exactly what happened next. For a few seconds, one, two, 3. Annie floated slowly and upright. She could hear the falls roaring even through the thick oak barrel. And there she goes. And that was about all the prayer she had time for. Oh, Lord, she whispered, and then she was gone. So here's the crowd that's gathered at the bottom, and it was, as I say, a very large crowd, and they're spotting the barrel up there and not knowing exactly what's going to happen when it hits the bottom. There's Annie as she has that, you know, caught in an elevator feeling that's lost its ropes, falling down. And miracle of miracles, these men who are there to watch and to act as her rescuers jump into the water. They pull the barrel to the shore, knock open the lid, and there's Annie inside. And the first, she didn't know she was she didn't know she was over yet. So it's the first thing she asked was, "Where am I?" And the man answered, "You are over the falls." So she wasn't badly injured. I mean, she got knocked around, and probably she got knocked around worse in the rapids, not in going over the falls itself. And she needed to recuperate a little bit. Everything that she had planned up to this point was working out fine. Reporters from all over America came. They read about it. You could read about it in San Francisco, New York, St. Louis. And it was big news because people couldn't believe that someone could do that. And what was even more remarkable was that it was a woman who had done it. It was just, as I say here, they could not have been more amazed if they'd read a horse had hit a home run or a baby had been elected president. So that part, the plan was working out fine. And Frank Russell, her Carney Barker manager, wanted to get her on the road as quickly as possible. So as soon as she was recovered from her minor injuries, they hit the road. And she went into theaters, and here's where the plan went downhill. Because she'd been promoted as a 42-year-old adventuress, people had in their minds what they were going to see when they entered the theater. And when they walked into the theater and saw someone who looked like their grandmother, they couldn't put it together. Could this actually be the woman who achieved this amazing feat? This would be like, I don't know, Alan Shepard after he went into space, showing up with a space capsule, and you walked in and you saw Alan Shepard was 96 years old. It wouldn't make sense to you. The result of this was that as her tour went on, audiences got smaller and smaller, and finally Frank Russell stole her barrel because the barrel was more interesting to most people than Annie. I should say that Annie was not a particular charismatic presenter from the stage. She got another manager who demoted her, took her off the theater circuit, and put her on the Carney circuit, where she would have to fill in between the different acts. And you can see here with her barrel, it's on a little dolly, so she can roll it out when the juggler is done. And she wasn't much more successful at carnivals and county fairs than she was on the theater circuit. The second manager also stole her barrel. And stole it for good. She never got it back. And he also did something especially nasty. He hired a younger, more attractive woman to be Annie Edson Taylor. And they went to other engagements where this younger woman would pretend to be Annie Taylor. But Annie got a lawyer, got them to stop that. And she returned to Niagara Falls. And basically she'd run out of steam. She thought, you know, the hard part was actually going over Niagara Falls and living. But it really turned out that the hard part was being able to use the celebrity that she'd gotten from having gone over the falls, and it just never worked out for her. So she spent the last years of her life, and they were considerable, last 20 years of her life, selling souvenirs at a park near the falls, and you know, signing autographs, trying to persuade people, even the tourists who came by, you know, she'd you know, invite them over and just to get a signature from the Queen of the Falls, and they'd get up to the barrel and they'd want to know where the Queen of the Falls was. And she said, "You're looking at him, or her." So she did that for 22 years, avoided the poorhouse, did not, you know, end up in the worst place she could have, was able to support herself through the end of her life. That's a sad story. And the problem for me as a storyteller was How does it end in a way that is not just simply depressing? That a sympathetic character has this incredible idea. They overcome the obstacles to the challenge. They survive a deadly thing. They take on risk. When we meet characters like that in stories, we want to see them rewarded. And at this point, Annie was unrewarded. She was almost kind of victimized. But in my research, I discovered that on the 10th anniversary of her triumphant passage over the falls, a newspaper reporter came to interview her and ask her, you know, how did you feel about it? How did it turn out for you? She said, well, it didn't turn out well. No, sir. I did not get rich from it, and that has been a disappointment. I won't deny it. She stood up, took a few steps forward, and gazed at the falling water. When I was 9 years old, she said, I stood here with my father in this very spot. I'd never seen anything like that waterfall. It looked like the end of the world. Beautiful and dreadful all at once, my father took my hand and asked if I was frightened. I told him I was. Then I asked if we could get closer. Now, that conversation I made up. But I did know that she was a fearless person, and I did know that she'd visited the falls with her father at that age. But I did not make up the following, which is what redeems the story in my mind. She turned back to the reporter. That's what everyone wonders when they see Niagara. How close will their courage let them get to it? Well, sir, you can't get any closer than I got. You ask any person who stood here looking out at those falls what they thought of someone going over them in a barrel. Why, every last one would agree. It was the greatest feat ever performed. And I am content when I can say I am the one who did it. So this was her reward. Finally, not the money that she thought she was going to get, not the acclaim. What she got is really finally the only thing you can depend on when you take on a challenge, is not the anticipated acclaim and admiration of people who may or may not see it. All you can really depend on is knowing that you did something that was a challenge to you. And that's what she got finally in the end. And also the fact that she will forever be the first woman to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel. So that's the story of Annie Edson Taylor. A few minutes for questions, maybe. Does anybody have some Q's? I'll give some A's. Right here in the red, yes. Okay, that's a good question, which is, why are some of my books in color, some in black and white? You know, a story like the Polar Express, because it happened in winter, I thought like I needed some of the cool colors of, you know, blues and things like that to make sure, to show that it was cold. In a book like The Stranger, which takes place in autumn, I thought the orange and golds to suggest autumn. So sometimes it's this desire to create a sense of what the place really feels like. This story took place, 110 years ago. They didn't have color photography. Most of the images that we see from that time are kind of black and white or sepia. So it seemed like this fit the bill, this particular choice of colors that I used here. So it has a lot to do with, you know, when the story happens and what I think are important parts of the story.
I was looking for the little dog Fritz throughout the book, and I found him. I was glad to see him in here.
Yes.
I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit about why you include that dog in your books.
Okay, the second, after where do I get my ideas, the second most frequently asked question is, what's with the little white dog? The very first book I wrote had as a central character in the book a little white dog, a bull terrier. I didn't have a dog like that. I don't know if you know much about bull terriers, but they're difficult pets. But I talked my brother-in-law into buying one. He was going to get a golden, and I said, oh, everyone's got a golden. You should have a more interesting dog than that. And so he got a bull terrier. And that dog, which was given the name Winston, became my model for Fritz, which is the character of the dog in the first book. Not long after that, sorry to report, the dog lost a territorial battle with a UPS truck and died. And so with a little bit of sincerity, maybe a tiny bit of irony, I thought I would always remember the contribution the dog had made to that first book. And so he is included in every book in some form or another since that first one. So the real dog's name was Winston, and as a character, it's Fritz. So he's always there. And there is one book that stumps people. Actually, there's a couple, because I don't always play fair. Sometimes it's just a little part of the dog, and sometimes the dog's not as big as it should be, but always there. Okay, the question is, I'm such an incredible storyteller. That was the question. I didn't say it. And such an incredible artist. I didn't say that either. But thank you. I think when I first started working, I thought of myself primarily as an illustrator because that was my background. I went to art school, did not study illustration or picture making, actually studied sculpture, taught myself how to draw after I graduated from Rhode Island School of Design. But I came to storytelling as a result of picture making. I would draw pictures, and they seemed to have stories, and I was encouraged to think of my pictures as illustrations. So I've done 17 books, and I would say maybe up to the 8th, 9th book, I still thought of myself as a picture maker who would accompany his pictures with a story. Though I never did finish pictures without finishing the story, so the story always comes first. But I still thought that my main contribution to my work was as the illustrator. But since then, I've come to think of myself as a picture book author, where I don't distinguish between the two. I make pictures and I write stories, and the goal for me is to get them to work together in a way that makes something that's greater than the sum of its parts. It's better than a story without the pictures, and it's better than just a bunch of pictures strung together.
The faces are so memorable. Like, will we see these people walking around Providence?
Okay. So the question is, do I use models? The faces are memorable and specific. Yes, I do. There's a few things I've never made up. I make up interior spaces. I can draw rooms very easily. I can draw lots of things because I understand the principles of perspective and lighting and things like that, and that empowers you to draw a lot of things that can seem quite real but don't exist. It's very difficult to draw convincingly a human figure that has the correct proportions, that has the way the folds and the fabric, the clothing that they're wearing, all that. So I always use models for figures. The model for Annie Taylor, I was searching for a woman who seemed to be the right character, the right model. And I have pictures. This is Annie Taylor right here, by the way. That's a picture of Annie. So I was not looking for a model who bore a strong physical resemblance. I was looking for a woman who had something more like a 19th century bearing and appearance. And I went to my daughter's algebra parent-teacher conference, and her teacher was sitting there. I hadn't met her before, and she had this hair up in a bun, and she had wire-rimmed glasses on. And after we talked about how Anna was doing with her equations, I asked her if she was interested in doing some modeling. And and I explained it to her, and she seemed pretty open-minded. And then I said, you know, it's a costume thing, and I'm going to get period clothes. I had already contacted a costumer that I knew because I wanted her to be in the right clothing. And I said, you're going to have to wear a corset. And she says, well, I think I can do that. So she was game, and so that's a real character. For the most part, I do use real models because, like in cinema, you can convey so much with the human expression because human beings are so sensitive to reading the human face. And to not use that as a book illustrator seems to me to be an incredible lost opportunity because you can convey so much by showing the expression on a human face. You don't have to have all the, you know, descriptions of their emotions there. So, you know, like when Annie went through her epiphany, you know, a slightly distracted look and then a look of amazement. I had to have modeled. I can't make those up. Though I do say sometimes when I get a model to hold a pose and I sketch it, sometimes it's not as extreme as I would like it to be. So then I take a mirror out and I use my own face because, you know, faces have lots of things in common. So the expressive folds and wrinkles and sets of the jaw that are common to human emotion are just that. So I would sometimes embellish some of these exaggerate some of her expressions by looking in the mirror and adding a little of myself to them. And people have observed that a lot of the people in my books look like me. That's probably why. So, yes. Well, you know, for a lot of authors, that's the end of the rainbow, you know. A feature-length film, a Hollywood production from my book, and it seems like, an ability to find an audience that your book couldn't find by itself. I mean, so it's kind of exciting, but the downside is that, you know, first, when someone options a book, you don't want to get too excited because only maybe one out of 25 optioned books actually gets turned into a movie. And because I feel strongly in keeping my emotions in check, it wasn't when Sony first called me about Jumanji, I didn't run down to the nearest pub and say, you know, set them up, it's on me. I thought, well, maybe it'll be a movie, maybe it won't. And it came close to not being a movie because the early scripts were really pretty bad, and so I actually wrote them a story treatment that restarted the process. But the downside is that often with children's books, if there's a large audience that a studio feels will be in place just simply based on the familiarity of the title, they'll make a really cheesy exploitive film. They'll try to sell a lot of tickets in the first two weekends, and they'll call it quits. And for an author who suffered through that, that's not worth the check they gave you because that can just, you know, make you feel bad for the rest of your life. But I've had three films made, and each one was highly budgeted, had the full backing of the studio, and in each case had directors who may not have had the same ideas I had, but were really committed to making high quality entertainment for kids. That was not cheesy and ironic or exploitive. So I feel like I've been pretty lucky about the film versions of my books. Okay, last two questions. The contract a rights holder, an author has with a studio, there are probably a couple of exceptions. You know, maybe the late Michael Crichton probably had some leverage. I'm sure Stephen King has some leverage. John Grisham has some leverage, and that may be it. The contract that I signed with them gave me status as a consultant, but there's no legal authority that goes with that, and your ability to influence the project is mostly depends on the relationship and communication you're able to establish with the filmmakers. Okay, final question, back here.
What kind of paper and pencils do you use?
Okay. Yeah, the question is, what kind of materials do I use for the different books? And one of the ways I keep the process interesting for myself is I'm always changing. There's probably only two books of the 17 I've done where I use the same materials. This last book, I knew that when I began that there would be at least five or six images of falling water in this story. And the way water breaks up as it goes over a precipice is very recognizable and it's very specific. And drawing the dark spots around the highlights would be almost impossible. So I knew when I started this out that I wanted to be able to draw at least some of the image with a very light material on top of a dark ground. So these pictures are done on a fairly dark paper, and then a lot of the pictures drawn with a white crayon and then a lot of the shadows are drawn with a black crayon. And that was a decision that was made entirely based on the need to convincingly depict falling water. Okay, so that's it. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.